Thanks, IT. Judge Conklin.
I'm here finally.
Ms. Fleming.
And we were told that she would not be available.
Thank you, Judge. Judge Buckley.
And I got a message from Judge Buckley that, like me, he's in a trial and he anticipated he would not be available.
Thank you, Judge. Judge Fannin.
Here.
Judge Gabe. Oh, she's absent as well. Sorry about that. Judge Kelly.
Here.
Judge Larsh. Judge Ryan.
Present.
Judge Sachs. Judge Thompson. Judge Zinger.
I'm here.
Thank you. Ms. Bartleson.
Here.
Got it. Mr. Finke.
Here.
Mr. Harrigan.
Good afternoon. I'm here.
Thank you. Mr. Kim.
Here.
Mr. Landry.
Here.
Ms. Levere.
Here.
Mr. Riley.
Here.
Mr. Rule. I thought I saw him. Oh, I see him. We cannot hear you, Chris. I will mark you here, and we can see we can't help you with a technical issue. Anything you want to speak about, you can always send me an email, and I can make sure your thoughts get shared with the group. Mr. Taniguchi.
No.
Okay. Mr. Taylor.
Here.
Mr.
I see David right there. David.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear. It was a little breakup. Good afternoon. I'm here.
Thank you, David. Mr. Wardlaw.
Yes, good afternoon.
Thank you. And Ms. Mueller.
Good afternoon, everyone. Here.
Thank you so much.
Brandy, I was trying to track that. I know we had quite a few that hadn't answered up yet. Does that give us a quorum?
Yes, that does.
Okay.
We've got Judge Sachs is here, by the way.
Excellent.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As is Judge Larsh.
Judge Larsh is here. Thanks.
Oh, and even better.
For those listening in, the fact that people are coming in right now doesn't exemplify they're late. It exemplifies they're busy. And they're trying to get out of trial courts and other meetings to attend to us. We so appreciate that. But we do have a quorum, so we can conduct our business, which starts off with a motion to approve the minutes from the August 5th meeting. Those minutes have been distributed to all members. I'd invite a motion to approve from anybody who was present at that meeting.
Yamasaki moves.
Bartleson seconds.
Moved and seconded that the minutes be approved. And with that, is there any objection to the minutes being approved? Hearing no objection, the minutes are approved. So we are also, and I'm just stating the obvious, we're in a public meeting, but it is on a Zoom format, and the public comment has been modified to accommodate the Zoom format, which allows for public comment, written comment to be submitted, and then written comment to be distributed to all committee members. We did receive written comment, and I believe it was four, I have them right here, four written comments, and they have been distributed to all committee members for review of those public comments. Is there any, besides those four public comments, Brandy, anything else come in? And I did allow, as chair, I have the discretion to allow public comments that are submitted late with good cause to be accepted, and I exercise that. Some of these came in after the deadline yesterday, but just like I commented on, the members that are busy on this committee, the folks that submitted them weren't late, they were busy. And so I allowed each of those to be distributed to all members. I didn't want to imply that rule is not typically honored, but given the challenging times we're in, we obviously do our best to accommodate all public comment. And that public comment has been distributed to all. Brandy, before we move to the discussion items, have I left anything out?
You got it, Judge. Thank you.
Okay. So, folks, we have three items on our agenda today of to discuss. One is an action item we'll get to in just a moment, and two are information items. So I know we have a couple, some new members on the committee. Candidly, I'm just trying to remember if this is your first or second meeting, but all of you are experienced for matters that are action items. We have that those items, like I think most committees do, presented by a subject matter expert, then open it up to questions to that expert and discussions, and then if appropriate, invite a motion and then comments on the motion. So following that format, our first matter this morning or this afternoon is being presented by Audrey Fancy from CFCC, addresses an action item of federally funded dependency representation, that is funding allocation methodology for the general fund supplement. So Audrey, and I know you will, but I'm gonna ask you to sort of give us a little bit of a background on this and then the item itself. Go ahead.
Judge Conklin, this is, I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is Judge Siebert. I got disconnected a couple times. I missed the, I heard the roll call, then in the middle of it, I got disconnected. I just wanted to let you know I'm on the call. Thank
you. We'll show you present. Thank you so much. Audrey, go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. And I'm joined today by my colleague, Kelly Milip, and Chad Finke is also, I believe, going to be joining us toward the end of the presentation. We're here today to discuss new state funding to augment the federally funded dependency representation program. Kelly's going to provide a little bit of background on that program, and then I will discuss the work of the funding methodology subcommittee and the proposed methodology.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, Audrey. So we first wanted to start with some background information about the program. FFDRP was implemented in fiscal year 1920 following a 2019 change to the Child Welfare Policy Manual, which was updated by the Administration for Children and Families to add and make clear that legal representation for children and parents is an eligible Title IV-E administrative cost. Traditionally, Title IV-E federal foster care funds were limited to child welfare workers and agency counsel. Following this change, the Judicial Council's Court Executives Advisory Committee formed an ad hoc working group to assist with FFDRP program development. Then in late fiscal year 1920, the Judicial Council entered into a three-year contract with the California Department of Social Services, who is the California Title IV-E pass-through agency for these funds. And then we began contracting with providers. California was an early adopter of this program before the Children's Bureau issued program guidance. And during implementation, we received new guidance and clarification that required our providers to make adjustments that were challenging and very time-consuming. In order to participate in the program, providers must first complete an FFDRP application that puts forth a plan to implement attributes from an established list for the purpose of improving the quality of legal representation, as well as a proposed budget for use of the funding. These applications must also be reviewed and approved by the court before we enter into a contract with providers. To establish FFDRP funding allocations, we first determine the available funding for each court based on their proportional share of court-appointed counsel funding. We then establish individual provider allocations based on their proportional share of the court's court-appointed counsel funding. The FFDRP reimbursement amounts are subject to the California Title IV-E eligibility rate, which for fiscal year 21-22 is 54%, though I'd like to point out that this rate does potentially change from year to year. The reimbursement amounts are also subject to the federal 4E administrative reimbursement rate of 50%. To give you an example of a potential shortfall, if a provider has an FFDRP contract for up to $10,000 and they are able to bill at 70%, they would receive a reimbursement of $7,000, leaving a gap in funding of $3,000. We do also want to share some program information and statistics with you from fiscal years 1920 and 2021. In fiscal year 1920, which was our first year of implementation, we paid out $26 million in FFDRP reimbursements. At that time, we had a total of 61 providers from 20 across the state. That $26 million in reimbursements fell short of our best case estimate for a number of reasons, which I'll go over in just a moment, but it does represent 62% of the FFDRP contracts. The total reimbursement amounts were affected by multiple factors, one being that not all activities that are funded by court-appointed counsel funding are eligible for federal match. For example, activities related to individualized education plans, individualized family service plans, special immigrant juvenile status, restraining orders, collaborative courts, and other non-case-specific activities. Other factors that impacted payouts were that some providers were unable to implement and match the enhancements approved during the application process because we implemented the program late in the fiscal year. Compiling the detailed documentation required to properly claim for federal reimbursement also presented some challenges. As I mentioned earlier, not all activities are eligible for federal reimbursement. And some of our providers received federal loans and grants, such as PPP loans, which are ineligible for federal reimbursement. In fiscal year 2021, the Administration for Children and Families examined our FFDRP program guidance on eligible activities and expenses. During this time, FFDRP staff instructed providers to track uncertain items separately, and most of our providers opted not to bill until we received clarity regarding eligible activities and expenses. We did receive guidance and clarification in late spring, and we are now reviewing and processing invoices for fiscal year 2021.
So the page has moved, but I'm not hearing Kelly anymore.
Actually, you're supposed to be hearing Audrey. I'm so sorry. I forgot to go off mute as I started speaking. thank you. Cognizant of billing challenges and with a desire to fully fund the Council's court-appointed counsel caseload goal of 141 clients, the legislature set aside $30 million annually to fill this gap. The Council is required to submit a report in April 2022 detailing the total federal reimbursements invoiced statewide in the first two quarters of the current fiscal year, any projected shortfalls through the end of the current fiscal year as compared to the $57 million in expected federal reimbursements, and a proposed allocation and distribution of any portion of the $30 million necessary to address projected shortfalls. The Budget Act further directs us to work in collaboration with court-appointed dependency council providers on timely invoicing to ensure we have an accurate assessment of what the amount of federal funding can be achieved. In order to submit a legislative report by April, we propose the following timeline. This fall, developing a methodology in consultation with providers so that we can bring a report to the Judicial Council at their January 2022 meeting, and then work on a legislative report for the March Judicial Council meeting in order to meet the April 1st, 2022 deadline. After that point, we will receive some funding to distribute to eligible providers, and then any unused funds will be reverted to the state general funds as of October 1st, 2022. In conversations with the Department of Finance and referring to language in the 2021 Budget Act, it is clear that the Council is to propose a system for allocating and distributing the additional dollars that will, quote, address any shortfalls in federal reimbursement. Therefore, only those providers who have entered into an FFDRP contract are eligible for this augmentation funding. Judicial Council staff are currently asking non-participating courts about their interest in having their court-appointed counsel providers join FFDRP. The methodology would ask that by December 31st, providers either join the program or provide a notice of intent to access these additional funds for the current fiscal year. To further meet the requirement of participation, FMS proposes requiring monthly invoicing absent extraordinary circumstances. The Funding Methodology Subcommittee also recommends a two-phase process for payment schedule. For the current fiscal year, given the requirement of an April 2022 legislative report, a lump sum payment is the only workable time frame. However, as an ongoing allocation, a quarterly payment structure is recommended to balance the need for provider cash flow and program fidelity. Given the invoice projection Kelly mentioned, it is highly unlikely we will exceed the $30 million budget at this time. Assuming the gap is less than $30 million, FMS proposes funding all providers with FFDRP contracts for the full amount of the shortfall between their FFDRP contract and total billing. However, were the gap to exceed $30 million, FMS proposes a proportional distribution mirroring the underlying court-appointed counsel allocation process where initially all providers would receive a proportional increase matching the shortfall. And if any providers exceed their contract cap, those excess funds would be made available to other providers. The value of this approach is that we'll incentivize aggressive invoicing while providing much needed relief to all providers. As noted earlier, the budget bill requires provider engagement in this process. To meet this requirement, staff has met three times with our FFDRP communication team comprised of a cross-section of providers to gather their feedback. The latest meeting was earlier today, and their input echoes the comment received for today's meeting, supportive of the four recommendations. This comment was from a coalition of providers from a cross-section of courts comprised of Los Angeles, Placer, Sacramento, San Diego, Santa Clara, Alameda, Ventura, San Mateo, San Joaquin, Mendocino, Lake, Sonoma, Marin, Solano, Yolo, and Stanislaus counties. I will turn this over to Chad for any additional comments, but we would be happy to answer any questions you have about the FFDRP program, this new funding, or the proposed methodology.
Thanks, Audrey. So as you probably saw in the materials, it was Judge Buckley put together a subcommittee of the FMS subcommittee to look at this issue. And the subcommittee comprised Judge Buckley, Rebecca Fleming, me, and James Kim from Marin. And so we did have a couple of meetings. We got a lot of very helpful information from Audrey and Kelly. This is not necessarily the most intuitive area in the world if you're not immersed in it, but I think they got us up to speed very quickly. And so these are the four recommendations that we're putting forward. And as Audrey said, we thought some of the key principles were that we should provide funding to all providers who have FFDRP contracts. We considered whether it should they have to be in contract by the end of this calendar year, but we ultimately decided so long as they've sort of submitted an intent to get into contract, that would be sufficient. And we did, and I think the other part, just to sort of highlight, it's on page 4 of the report, we did consider whether there ought to be some minimum billing threshold before they would get funding. So for example, I'm just making this up, but 50% to go, you saw the example Kelly gave earlier, 50% billing, and then they're eligible. We were concerned that we were trying to look at the data to figure out what an appropriate threshold might be. And the data it's sort of so in flux at this point that we didn't feel that we could make sort of a well-informed recommendation about a threshold amount, which is why the recommendation is it to not have that for this year, to simply fund everybody, whatever their gap is, fund it. And as has been noted in the materials, it appears quite likely that $30 million will enable us to do that without, worry that we're going to exceed the $30 million. So I support these recommendations. I, as a member of the subcommittee, I'm not sure if I can be the one to make the motion or not, although I happily would, but I'll stop talking to see if there are any questions.
And let me preface, I don't have a question for you, Chad. Nice work. I just wanted to preface a few things. As I think everybody on this committee recognizes, sometimes the hardest work starts at the bottom of an issue and works its way to the top, which is where we are here. So I truly appreciate the working group that Judge Buckley appointed and the work that, and so again, just as a general structural reminder, we have all our subcommittees. One of them is the funding methodology subcommittee that considers just that, funding methodologies, this related to these funds. That committee, for more work, referred it out to Chad's working group. They then came back to FMS after all this hard work. FMS considered it, vetted it, and after their hard work has now referred it to us. I really appreciate the four recommendations being up on the screen. That makes it easy. So we're now to the stage where if there's any questions for our presenters or for Chad about these recommendations, now's the time. And if not, Chad, I think you're right. Perhaps I'd invite a motion from somebody who wasn't on the working group just to avoid, I think it's proper, but just to avoid any issues.
Judge Conklin, this is David Yamasaki. I would move to approve all of the recommendations. The detail that was provided by Audrey and Kelly, and certainly by Chad as well, were sufficient for me to, you know, answer certain questions that I had, and I think the approach is something that we should move forward with.
Bartleson second.
Thank you so much. So it's been moved and seconded that the recommendations set forth at page 4 of your report and now shown on the screen be approved. It's now an open motion for any further concerns or discussion. And if not, my practice as the chair, especially in a Zoom format, is to ask if there's any objection to the motion to approve the four recommendations from any committee member. I hear no objections, and therefore, hearing no objections, as the chair, I'm deeming the four recommendations unanimously approved. I'm going to give Chad Finke the quote of the day award for this issue is not the most intuitive that we have addressed. This is a thorny issue. It's an issue that we've worked at for years and we will continue to address, but I so appreciate the accomplishments shown by the working group, FMS, and this committee as a whole in approving these recommendations. So thank you all, and to both the presenters, you guys did such a good job helping somebody like me understand a complicated matter. That's an accomplishment. So thank you both very much.
Thank you.
With that, we're gonna now move to, that's the end of our discussion, pardon me, of our action items. We now have two discussion items or informational items. I remind the members that as informational items, we will discuss these, but we will not entertain motions or recommendations at this point because we can't. They were agendized as informational items only, and that's the way they're treated. So the first is informational item number one. It's set out in your materials beginning at page 10 of 15. And it's going to be presented today by Douglas Denton from CFCC. So unless I've left anything out, Douglas, we turn to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Conklin, and good afternoon, committee members. As Judge Conklin mentioned, there's a memo in your materials. I'm going to give a brief overview. Senate Bill 170 recently amended the 2021 Budget Act and provides $30 million in one-time general fund for a new court interpreter employee incentive grant, which is intended to increase the number of new interpreters in trial courts and to increase language access services for court users inside courthouses. There are two categories of grants. For the first category, $18 million of the $30 million is dedicated to 1 year of salary and training costs for new interpreter employee positions. To qualify for a grant, a court must have spent more than 20% of its interpreter funds on independent contractor interpreters or part-time employees who provided services in any of the languages described in Civil Code Section 1632B for at least two consecutive years in the past 4 years. And that Civil Code section identifies Spanish, Chinese, so Mandarin or Cantonese and spoken, Tagalog, Vietnamese or Korean as languages that are widely spoken at home in California among LEPs. The court must demonstrate that a new full-time employee hired pursuant to the grant is intended to remain employed beyond the grant year to replace a roughly equivalent expenditure on independent contractor interpreter services. The court must also commit to retaining the court interpreter employee positions beyond the grant year. Thus, participating courts will be responsible for paying subsequent years of salary through the court's annual court interpreter program allocation or operational funds as needed. The other category of grants is $12 million for 1 year of salary and training costs for new interpreter employee positions for out-of-courtroom services. Courts qualify for these grants if the court can demonstrate that at least 80% of its interpreter services in the languages described in the same civil code are provided by court interpreter employees. For both categories of grants, courts may apply for grants to high interpreters in other languages if the court can demonstrate that there is a local need for interpreter employees in other languages. The $30 million in one-time grants shall also be available for expenditure and encumbrance until June 30th, 2024. We're planning to send a memo to go out to the courts this month, letting them know of the creation of the Court Interpreter Employee Incentive Grant and that grant applications will commence in fall 2021 and conclude in early 2022. Once applications are received, Judicial Council staff will work to develop a report with grant recommendations. The draft report will include information on the program, including the number of courts that applied, the number of interpreters and languages requested by each interested court, recommended awards, and remaining funding. And then once applications for grants are evaluated, the report with recommendations will then be developed for approval by this committee, TICBAC, the Judicial Council Budget Committee, and the Judicial Council by spring of 2022. So Judge Conklin, that concludes my presentation. I'm happy to address any questions or suggestions.
So I truly appreciate that, Doug. And I see that we've got John Wardlaw with us too. I'm not sure who this is best addressed to, and I want to be very careful. And this is just my perception. We always appreciate additional sources of funding, and grant funding is one of those additional sources. It seems like this grant does have some rather particular requirements to allow for the reception of funds, including a local court's commitment that they would hire an interpreter for beyond the grant period. So again, without implying, and I'm not, that these funds are not necessary, is there also perhaps some work being done to provide to those outside the branch an understanding of how that grant money might not be applied for if courts feel that they aren't able to make that commitment? I just don't want the perception to be, hey, we don't need this money when we do. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. And I think that's something we'll definitely work on when we communicate out to the courts, the parameters of the grant program. We also do meetings with language access reps. So each county has a language access representative, and we also can explain the parameters of the grants more fully. The other thing that we'll have to see is, depending on the volume of applications, we may be able to have some flexibility based on what funding is available. So it's a little bit to be determined, but yeah, I think your point is good. I think we have to be clear in our communication.
Yeah, because we've been striving for so long to recognize the importance of interpreters, the need for funding, and I just don't want anybody outside the branch to say, well, we put $30 million on the table and it wasn't grabbed up right away, because there might be other reasons. John, is that anything that is coming to your radar, or? Everything's in your radar, I guess, but.
Thank you, Judge. I think your point is right on the mark. And as Douglas has said, I think it's a need for communication, both with the courts and with outside parties, to make sure everybody is aware of the requirements associated with the funding. And so that's that. I think Douglas and the program we'll do a good job in making sure that all parties are aware.
Great. And I didn't mean to take up everybody's time. Obviously, any other questions are welcome.
This is Judge Kelly. I had a quick question. When the information from the recently passed legislation talks about a local need for interpreter employees in other languages, the phrasing local need, is that tied into the same methodology as the 20% from the four prior fiscal years, or is there some further information about what a court would need to do to show local need?
That's a good question. Our understanding is that as long as a court spends more than 20% of its interpreter expenditures on contractors, they can apply for a grant. And then if they can show a local need, so for example, if they had a large Hmong community and frequently used contractors for Hmong, then they would be eligible to apply for a grant for an interpreter in that language.
Great, thank you.
Sure.
Any other questions of Douglas on this issue? All right, doesn't appear to be any. Douglas, thank you so much for your typically thorough presentation. We're work in progress, I guess, is the best way as we describe this, as well as the next item, and work to be done. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, folks, so that now moves us to our second discussion item. Again, an item for information to help us understand this issue as we will move forward on the issue. And I see Rob has opened up his camera. So good to see you, Rob. So Rob O'Young is going to present on this issue regarding the $37 million in ongoing funding for court reporters in family law and civil cases, and then for increased transcript rates. Again, this is not an action item, it's a discussion item. And Rob, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you, Judge Conklin, and good afternoon, committee members. I also have with me Corey Jasperson, who's the Director of Judicial Council Governmental Affairs as well. So Senate Bill 170 amended the Budget Act of 2021 and included two items related to court reporters. First, $30 million is to be allocated by the Judicial Council in a manner that ensures all courts receive funds to increase the number of court reporters in family law and civil law cases without supplanting existing expenditures in these areas. Secondly, $7 million is available for the Judicial Council to establish a methodology to allocate a share of resources to all courts to cover the cost associated with increased transcript rates. The courts have reported increasing difficulty in finding enough court reporters over the past few years, so this has been a high priority for court leadership. According to the California Department of Consumer Affairs annual licensing statistics, the total number of license certified shorthand reporters in California has continually declined for the past 10 years for a total of almost 20%. So we need to allocate both the $30 million for court reporters and $7 million for court transcripts as expeditiously as possible. So therefore, I would recommend that a work group be formed to quickly determine the best manner in which to allocate these funds.
Rob, thanks so much. Corey, is there anything you wanted to add to that?
Judge, I think that Rob covered it nicely. I would just add that, you know, this is a very high priority for the legislature. It's been on the agenda in the legislature a few times now in the last few years, and so it's something that is getting a lot of attention in the Capitol.
Thanks. So I appreciate the way both of you described that as a high priority, and I think that exemplifies how we address the services and the benefits of our court reporters is a high priority, and I think this continues hopefully to reflect that. Rob, I appreciate your suggestion of a working group. We're already on that. Timing is critical here. We recognize that. As the chair of this committee, I will just share that in years past, I've learned a very valuable lesson, and that is not to allow timing to take a priority over quality. And by that, I don't mean to imply that we don't think this is a critically important issue, and we don't think we have to be effectively expeditious. How's that for using two E words in getting this money out? But we can't let that desire overcome the need to have a quality item out. So we've got some deadlines coming up. I'm working with Rebecca Fleming. She's not with us for the next few days, but she'll be back on Monday to try to get a working group through FMS going, hopefully within the next 7 to 10 days, so they can get on this issue right away. Working groups are very effective. They'll then work through FMS, and we'll get this to TICBAC and then to the council as soon as we effectively can. So that's the plan from here, following up on Rob's suggestion, and now I open it up to questions or discussion at all. Okay, Neil, I saw your hand up. Go ahead. I'm not sure if we have a communication issue, Neil. I can't hear you.
Hey, is it? Can you hear me now?
There we go. I can hear you now.
All right. I have a question on the supplantation issue. So is there's a prohibition on supplanting existing funds. Is it based on the present number of court reporters that are, that trial courts have allocated to civil and family law matters, or is it based on the total amount of dollars that we're supposed to be spending on court reporters? As you know, most all the courts have significant vacancy rates in the court reporter ranks. Do we have to fill all those positions first before we can access these dollars?
You have a thought on that, Rob?
Yeah, so the language says that the funding shall not supplant existing trial court expenditures. So it's really focused on the existing trial court expenditures, not necessarily how many you should have filled, but it's really your existing trial court expenditures. And I'll also see if Corey or the budget team has any clarification there that they would like to provide.
I think Rob and Neil, the only additional clarification is just right there in the budget control language where it says that the funds are to be utilized exclusively to increase the number of court reporters in family law and civil law cases.
Yeah, I would echo, hello everybody, this is Lotko. I would echo the way Rob has described it. If you're not spending the money right now, then there's nothing to supplant. While we may have authorized positions, if there's no expenditure being made, then there's nothing supplanting. This is, again, intended to increase the number, and while you may have vacancies, if you're not spending funding on them, then they're not supplantable.
With that language you guys just quoted, does that mean that if you have a court that currently doesn't have enough court reporters to cover criminal, for example, or juvenile, they could get some of this money potentially under the methodology to be developed, but it would have to be used exclusively for family and civil, which means they would still have that gap for covering the mandatory case types. Did I hear that right?
These funds are exclusively for the family and civil. Okay. But that's the focus of these dollars, to increase the capacity in that area.
That seems pretty clear. I mean, at least as far as the language itself. So, you know, we have the public comments that have come in on this. Obviously those public comments will be distributed immediately to the members of the working group and the concerns expressed therein. I hate to quote my dad, but one of his favorite quote was, please remember folks, everybody's trying their best. And I think folks are trying their best here. I really do. But it's not an easy issue. So with that, any other discussions or questions for Rob or Corey? Truly appreciate their input.
This is Judge Siebert. I think a lot of the I raised my hand because I.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, that's all right. A lot of the questions were answered, but if somebody could address, you know, the courts that don't currently have any court reporters for civil and family law, how would this affect them? Would any money they get then just be to hire a new court reporter strictly for that? Family law, civil law departments?
Right, it's really intended to increase the total number.
And can you also, would those funds be available for a part-time position or a couple days a week kind of a thing, as opposed to a full-time court employee, court reporter?
I don't know, Z, do you have any clarification on that?
I don't think it speaks to the, it's a matter of just increasing the number. It's not that specific, Judge. So you know, I think we would see any improvement in the situation at a court, be it part-time, full-time, would still be an improvement consistent with the language.
Chad, did I see your hand go up for a second or not? Maybe not.
You did, Judge, but then I decided I will wait and see what the working group does. I'll hold my question until a future date. So thank you.
Okay. And this, by the way, I left out a critically important route. This will take through JBBC as well. So it'll go through the working group, through FMS, to tick back to JBBC, to the council. And while that sounds like a lot of steps, one of the few benefits of our current Zoom formats is we can pivot very quickly. So I'm still confident we can do this in a timely and effective manner.
Judge Conklin, this again, Judge Siebert, sorry to be the pest here, but you said that was a lot of steps. It's also a lot of acronyms.
I'm sorry. You know what? You make an excellent point.
New. Is there some cheat sheet for all these acronyms you're throwing around?
You know, Judge Siebert, I've got to thank you, because when I took over as chair, that's one of the first things I said. And look at me. Here I am violating my own concern. So it'll start off with a working group of the Funding Methodology Subcommittee, FMS. That's a subcommittee of TICBAC, which is what we're all on, the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee. The council recently moved us from the purview of executive to the Judicial Branch Budget Committee, which is chaired by Judge Rubin. So they now oversee us, so to speak, sort of like ITAC reports to the Judicial Council Technology Committee. So whatever recommendation we make is then vetted through the Judicial Branch Budget Committee, JBBC, to the JC, or the Judicial Council. And you're right, I'm gonna ask Brandy to once again get us a cheat sheet, just to all members, to say, please tell us what these acronyms are, and if there's missing acronyms, she'll fill it in. So Judge Siebert, I really appreciate your clarification. Anything further, folks?
Just one last thing, Judge Conklin, just wanted to let you know that Judicial Council staff stands ready to support the working group however you need.
Thank you. This is a recorded meeting, so I'm going to quote you on that because we'll need you. So we really appreciate the work you do. It's very important. And Corey's perspective as well, the work through his office. All right, folks. I want to make sure that takes care of all of our action items, discussion items. Brandy, have I left anything out for the good of the order?
No, you have not. Other than mentioning, Judge, our next TICBAC meeting is scheduled for November 16th. We're planning an educational session, and more information will follow.
And at that educational session, we'll have a special tutorial on acronyms.
Yes, we will.
All right. Glad to see everybody. I'm hoping that we are moving towards a more in-person format, but candidly, the effectiveness of this format we've been able to master. So thank you all. I'm going to, hearing no other questions, concerns, or issues being raised, please be well, and pardon my bias, but go Dodgers. We'll see everybody. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.